Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 79, section 3, which is old single column, page 881. Okay, so just if you flip back to the first part of this paper, remind yourself what we've done so far. We're talking about the andite expansion in the Orient, and they are moving to greater and greater distances away from Mesopotamia. So we first were looking at Turkestan, and then we moved further east to India. And obviously, we'll get to China after that. And we went through a description of those earliest andite movements into the subcontinent of India, which set the stage for what we're going to look at again in a slightly different mode tonight. Now, to begin tonight, what they describe there is Dravidian India. So initially, what you should think about when you see that reference is, in other words, the state of India in the wake of those first waves of andites being absorbed into the pre-existent evolutionary stock there, and producing a subsequent Dravidian culture. Okay, now what that root there, Dravida, is referring to, in literal terms, remember when they were talking about. In the preceding section, when they were talking about the Andites coming down from the north, basically, into India, and pushing the peoples that were there southward. Now, unfortunately, because of ocean on all sides to the south, right, they couldn't be pushed out of that area. They just get shoved down up against the water. Let's see, where was that? Literally, when they were talking about that. Somewhere in there, I can't remember exactly where it was. They literally mentioned that you've got the water in the way there. You can probably go back and find it yourself. But what that literal word is referring to is, it's the place of water, Dravida. See, in that very sense, that you're shoved down to the south there, and to the west you have the Arabian Sea, to the east you have the Bay of Bengal. To the south, you have the wide Indian Ocean. And so that just literally got put into the language. And so what's now spoken of as Dravidian peoples, or the languages of those peoples, those sort of aboriginal peoples, it's those peoples that got shoved down to the place of water. Right, place where there's just nothing but water on all sides. And recall also back there in the preceding section, I do remember where that is specifically, when they were pointing out that the relators are going to be using Dravidian to describe that whole general setting, not what came to be way down the road in terms of Aboriginal peoples, where they say, but the so-called Aborigines of India are hardly representative of these early people. They are rather the most inferior southern and eastern fringe, which was never fully absorbed by either the early Andites or their later appearing Aryan cousins. Okay. So Dravidian has come to indicate just those, the very tail of the bell curve of a former broad spectrum of Dravidian people. The center and the leading edge of the bell curve of which got absorbed into the early Andites and the subsequent Aryans, leaving just that tail to, when all is said and done, to be called Dravidian. Okay, so they wanted to make sure that we appreciated that they were going to, go back when you had the whole spectrum, and you had a, especially you had a leading edge of people that had benefited significantly from some Andite uplift. And so those, more sophisticated, you could even say spiritualized Dravidian people were trying to lead the way with a relatively progressive civilization compared to what was going on in most of the planet. The main focus of them speaking of Dravidian is not the tailing, the trailing end, but the leading, portion of those Dravidian people and the significance that they played and could have played. We already talked about that some. If only there had been a little bit more uplift and a few, fewer inferiors that, eventually drug everything down, that leading edge of Dravidian could have been quite significant. Okay, so that's the gist of it. Let's see here. Anything else we should bring in? Recall that when we ended those final two paragraphs of the preceding section were the politically incorrect paragraphs where they were speaking very directly about these racial issues. And as I promised, we're gonna set that aside for a moment again and just focus on, in many ways, the positive aspects relative to that time in the evolutionary process of what was going on. A little Andite makes a big difference. Especially relative to places that in the world at the time that had little or none. Not to mention not as diverse a Sangic stock that was being upstepped by that Andite blood. Because remember, we have all the different Sangic peoples and the Andonites and the Nodites blended into the evolutionary stock that's being engaged by these Andites. All right, I think that'll do it. Let's get into it a little bit here.
Number 3, Dravidian India. The blending of the Andite conquerors of India with the native stock eventually resulted in that mixed people which has been called Dravidian. The earlier and purer Dravidians possessed a great capacity for cultural achievement, which was continually weakened as their Andite inheritance became progressively attenuated. And this is what doomed the budding civilization of India almost 12,000 years ago. But the infusion of even this small amount of the blood of Adam produced a marked acceleration in social development. This composite stock immediately produced the most versatile civilization then on Earth.
So there you see it at the very end, saying what I was just saying a moment ago. and how it doesn't take any time. It immediately produced the most versatile civilization then on Earth. You have all of this internal complexity that gives the mind attuned, seated upon that genetics, has all the more adaptability, adaptation potential. Because of, you can play off of all that, all those different sort of lines of tendency, of inclination within you genetically. It's like the seventh adjutant coordinating the other six and giving you a full diversity of modes of operation for your mind. It's like, well, I need to bring in this much first adjutant and this much third adjutant, and et cetera, to have all of that, the different ways that you can play the components. But they are reminding you of what we, like I said, what we just read in the preceding two paragraphs, that, throughout all of human history, most fundamentally, there's only been one fact that has brought down a significant civilization, and that's mating with lesser peoples, and hence pulling the basic mind of those people down, so that they aren't as enlightened. They can't be as progressive. It doesn't matter if you're talking about here, like they just did, of that Dravidian civilization with a lot of initial promise being drugged down by mating with an inferior genetic stock, or you're talking about one of the fundamental reasons for the fall of the Roman Empire. The waning of the glories of ancient Greece, or whoever you're talking about.
So they use the term blood a lot. But it's really not the blood, right? It's the genetics, correct?
Why do they use the term blood?
Well, maybe that was the way that people talked in those
days. Well, it's not just the way that people talked in those days. It's the way we've always talked about it. Talk about bloodlines.
Bloodlines, right?
Right. And what does the word that they coined, sangic, mean? Literally means bloodline producing. They're just playing off of that, that way we've always spoken of.
Okay.
In the same way we still use the word melancholy, but we don't go, oh, so you're a believer in the old notions of humors. It's like, no.
Right, right. I'm just wondering,
that's
there's
just
not something hidden in that.
No.
It means the genetics.
Right? They're not saying there's something mystical about blood, and the ancients who believed that your soul was in the blood were true, were correct. No, they're not doing that. Right? They're just speaking of it in the way we've always spoken of it. It's just, as I almost always say, rather than saying, using that kind of, you could almost say colloquial expression, it's the genetics. Right. It's what ends up in your chromosomes. It's an issue here, not what's what kind of white blood cells you have or something in your bloodstream.
We have other interesting terms, like blue bloods.
Right.
We're considered red blooded Americans. We all bleed the same color.
Yeah.
It's kind of a way of saying we have a commonality regardless.
Right. It's just all, it's a very, very well-established mode of talking about such things, and so they're just, they make the book as evolutional as possible, to have it speak of things the way we speak of it. Remember, a lot of times it's literally, you know, so-and-so had a particular phrase for talking about something, and the revelators have an order that if that phrase, you know, is adequate, it doesn't lead to infinite distortion, then you've got to use it. You know, if Paul said it that way, you've got to put those, that phrase that Paul coined to describe something, you got to put those words in Jesus' mouth, right? You can't directly translate what Jesus said. You need to say it kind of the way it's come to be said, you know, on this planet. You know, and because remember, the whole point is not to give us the words of Jesus, because those are facts. They're to give us a sequence of words through which we can get the truth of what Jesus revealed. He's a revelator of truth, not a revelator of facts. Technically, there is no such thing as directly the revelation of facts. There's the disclosing facts. And then, though you might disclose facts in the context of revealing truth, but the whole point of part four is not to disclose the facts of Jesus' life. It's to, you know, and that's why so often they literally tell you that they're rephrasing this. But of course, everything is rephrased to some degree. You know, and a lot of times you can see that literally. It's like, wait a minute, that's a particular line in, you know, in Colossians or something, right? I mean, Paul wrote it that way. You know, and just like you're doing with the blood thing, you have to come to recognize, instead of saying, oh my goodness, are they saying that Paul actually somehow heard what Jesus said and was quoting Jesus when he wrote Colossians? No. It's like, well, how do you know? Well, because they tell you directly in the book that that's not the way they did it. They were told that if Paul said something, you know, in a very pithy way, use that way that Paul expressed it to convey the truth of what Jesus said, you know, and it can be a bit disconcerting if you find Jesus said colon, a, you know, quotation mark, you know, and a sequence of words, end quotation mark, and you go, oh, these are the words of Jesus because they're in quotation marks. You know, they're not.
Some editions are in red.
Yeah, or they might even be in red, right? You know, to highlight because they're the, right? So, no, they're never quoting the fact of what he said. That's not what quote marks mean in a revelation of truth. Quote marks are quoting the truth of what he said. Which can't be defined with words.
Some of the things he never said. God is
Well, I mean, obviously he never said anything in English.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, that's step one. I mean, and neither did Paul. Right? You know, so what you're really saying, oh, you mean that Jesus actually said it just like it is in the King James Version? Jesus wrote the King James Version? No, Jesus didn't write the King James Version. Right, I mean, and that's an. It seems like you know, on the one hand, it might seem like an intellectual, you know, sidetrack we're on here, or a potential stumbling block, but it's actually extremely important. I mean, you're not supposed to take the words in the book and carve them, in any paper in the book, let alone the ones that are in Jesus' quote marks, right, and carve them on a stone somewhere. Right? The whole point is to try to get truth, not words. You know,
there's no place to write that.
Right? And the only place that truth can be written is in the upper domain of the hourglass analogy of your mind. It can only be written in the stuff that's called spiritualized mind. It can't even be written in the mere adjutant mind in the lower domain. If you try to, you know, take a mindal pen and write those words down there, the words of truth, they cannot take form down there. They certainly can't take form on a chunk of marble. Okay? They can only take form, the forms of truth, in spiritualized mind. You know, and then you have to remind yourself that spiritualized mind is the lowest type of stuff that truth can take form in. And one day you'll have a lot fancier stuff that truth can take form in, that will be even further removed from granite or marble. Challenge yourself to resist that temptation to just, rest on the comfort of a sequence of words, which then just become a platitude that you spout, right? And no truth flows through them anymore. There's nothing that they're dead. They're not living. You can't obey them.
Well, you should say that, because oftentimes you can remember the truth in things that you read, but you can't always remember the words.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can remember the...
You can remember, the gist of it or the essence of it.
Paraphrase.
Yeah, and you'll paraphrase it, and you try to look up the paraphrase, and you can't find it. Right? We all know that. What you're pointing out, that instead of being frustrated by that, it's like, well... Maybe I'm relating more to the truth of it, and I'm not getting so fixated on the words. Now, the tricky thing is sometimes what someone remembers is in searching for and can't find is an interpretation of a passage, which is false. I've seen that one, so you have to guard against that. Put the words in an old wineskin and sort of reformed them, and you're remembering those reformed words, and they might not be as valid anymore. But nonetheless, anyway, back to the Dravidian people here. I wanted to stress is that we all know that when you get towards the end of the book and they're talking about what happened. Over the last 2,000 years, and they sweep through Roman times and the Dark Ages and et cetera, right? They give you a paragraph on what brought about the fall of Rome. And you could look at that just factually and say, okay, so here is, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, however many, key elements that led to the fall of Rome. Okay, I can memorize those facts as a scholar But that's not the point. The point is not to give you those as historical facts about why Rome fell. It's to see the truth that's flowing through those words and go, oh dear, that's going on right now. I mean, either literally the truth is factualized and that exact same fact is in play today, as is in that sentence from many centuries ago, or at the very least... Right, the essence of what's there, the truth that's flowing through it, is in play. Or if you will, the falsehood, right, that's flowing through it. We are not following truth, we're following that same thread of falsehood that those people followed back then and brought about the end of their civilization. That's what they're trying to give you, so that you can, you've got something that's relevant to your life today.
Michael's current state, he actually reviewed Ezra, was part of the process and essentially reading and comprehending it, improving it.
Michael trusts the evolutionary process, right? This is all delegated. Right, the Universal Father delegated just about everything, and he's not constantly, checking up. It's like, well, no, you can't send that email, Divine Counselor. You need to get me to approve it first. The Universal Father's not doing that. He trusts those who he delegated to. He's not like a lot of bosses in a lot of companies that, many of you might have experienced, right, that appears to delegate, but not really. He doesn't really trust anyone, and is micromanaging everyone. If anything, that's what we learn, that it seems to us that those on high delegate to a fault, right? I mean, they delegated to Lucifer unto rebellion. Shouldn't you have intervened? Right? You know, and think about what they're saying. Shouldn't you admit that you were wrong to begin with? Right? And you've made a mistake, and now you should probably put a rainbow in the sky and promise to never make a mistake like that again. See, that's the old way of thinking. That's the way we always think. It's like, no, they didn't make a mistake by putting Lucifer in charge. That was exactly the right thing to do. Not because it led to a rebellion, but in a much more objective thing than that. When all is said and done, there is no such thing as rebellions. Right? There are no black dots in supremacy. Rebellions aren't part of eternity. Right? There isn't really badness there. It just appears to be. So that trusting to the process. Okay. But that does, you know, we're looking for, well, I don't know, can I trust this book if Michael didn't review it?
I mean, if
one of the secondary midwayers wrote it? I'm supposed to think that's the authoritative elimination of error?
That is a matter of management.
Now, in the case of the secondary midwayers writing part four, yeah. Machiavent and Melchizedek was overseeing them.
So there
was some management there.
In fact, they had some disputes they had to work through.
Yeah, but again, it's not like they didn't allow the midwayers to kind of just speak their perspective and say, you know, we just really don't understand this. Okay, and you've got to recognize, okay, the secondary midwayers don't understand that. But that doesn't mean that there isn't someone in existence that understands it. Like, maybe even you could, because you have an adjuster and they don't. Okay? That's a radical thought.
Well, and we have no right to expect that it's perfect. but it's vastly superior to anything else we have, so...
Right. I mean, again, nothing perfect can be given to us.
That's right.
They can only give us something that's good in evolutionary terms. It's perfecting, and it is perfecting. It is good, and it is true. It's not absolute, but it's true. Yeah, and again, that gets at, I don't think I know what the word true means. That's the whole process of trying to figure out how something can be less than absolute and still be true. Right? How could Chris Halverson, who's quite finite, quite imperfect, and quite incomplete, have any relationship to truth? And we could replace Chris Halverson by John Hay.
Step right up.
All right. I mean, it's, see, and again, it's like, well, obviously, there's no way in and of myself I could possibly have any relationship to truth. I must have been given something by grace that allows me, even in my lowly estate, to, in some very initial fashion, bridge that divide between time and eternity. They're the truths of eternity. And I'm way down in a very relative temporal state of affairs. Yeah, my encirclement in the Holy Spirit allows me to get there. With the addition of that little existential gift from the Father, a personality, and between the two, and a lot of reflective effort, I can begin to get to truth. I can take up a pen in my inner sanctum and form truth in my mind. I can be the author of truth in my mind because of that gift. Okay, and that's, you know, even though it seems far afield, that's fundamentally, like I said, we're talking about the leading edge of these Dravidian people back then. Those who, especially because of that Andite uplift, had an initial recognition of truth. And there was a civilization that manifested as a fruit of the Spirit. Fruit of their truth-filled, spiritualized mind. I produced a civilization, as they're saying there at the end, that stood out quite definitively relative to everything else on the planet at the time. Okay, what else do they say here?
Not long after conquering India, the Dravidian Andites lost their racial and cultural contact with Mesopotamia. But the later opening up of the sea lanes and the caravan routes reestablished these connections, and at no time within the last 10,000 years has India ever been entirely out of touch with Mesopotamia on the west and China to the east, although the mountain barriers greatly favored Western intercourse.
Okay, so there was some interaction with China, but you know, it's a lot easier to interact back to Mesopotamia. So you're going to have a significant interplay between the two cultures. And at no time within the last 10,000 years, so you know, from the beginning of the Neolithic forward, you know, when you still had Stone Age technology, you had this significant commerce connection with the Sumerians. You know, that just shows you again the, even though you've washed out the immediacy of the genetic uplift of from the Andites, the culture endures with much greater resiliency. They continue to you know, to follow suit with what was initiated. See, and that reminds you of your relationship to the Father. Right? The Father doesn't walk along with you in time. He just initiates you. And he doesn't have to walk along in time because it carries forward naturally. You can follow suit. Obviously, you could choose to not, but these people are choosing to follow suit, and you can choose to follow suit the way the Father initiated you as well. And it can endure. Okay, let's see. I think we got everything there, didn't we? Let's keep going.
The superior culture and religious leanings of the peoples of India date from the early times of Dravidian domination and are due in part to the fact that so many of the Sethite priesthood entered India, both in the earlier Andite and in the later Aryan invasions. The thread of monotheism running through the religious history of India thus stems from the teachings of the Adamites in the second garden.
Okay, so remember you see how we're kind of going through some of the things we went through before, but just putting them more in this in the kind of fleshing out the full cultural context rather than kind of just stepping through the timeline. And that very significant fact that there was a very definitive injection of Sethite teachings over there into India plays a big role. So, and again, that touches on what I just said about the Universal Father initiating you. you know, how religion, genuine religion, is the spark that lights the sphere of philosophy about its nucleus. You've got the same thing being pointed out here. Right, that there, the fact that there's some relatively advanced religious ideas being put forward, coming from Mesopotamia, is the key spark that ignites this civilization. Let's see here, and what else do we have there? I notice where they say, in both cases, both the earlier Andite and in the later Aryan invasions. So that's an important reason why they're telling you before in the preceding section of how much potential was here, how sad it was that it couldn't really get going and benefit the rest of the planet. When they say they're the threat of monotheism running through the religious history of India, if not sort of in a more straightforward sense monotheism, it's at least henotheism, where you have one god above all other gods, and the people might actually take that henotheism to the point where, they only worship that highest god, but they allow for others, peoples, to have other gods, and deem those gods to be valid, but not worthy of worship. So that henotheism, which and usually it was the intermediate stage between polytheism and monotheism. You have a whole bunch of Olympian gods, but Zeus, gets elevated more and more above the others. And of course, all of that, that, like they're pointing out, the reason that there's that tendency for henotheism is because of revelatory teaching that there's one God. And so that just naturally sets up a situation where one god gets elevated above the others. And that one god that always gets elevated is the sky god. Right? Because that's, that ties to what they were being told. They were being told that there was, a god, way up in the heavens, right? Above the earth, and some god of the earth, above the atmosphere, and some god of the atmosphere, right? That there's a god in the heavens, right? That there's a sky god. Okay, and so, right, that sky god or sky father, right? That like Zeus or whomever in the different cultures, it's all coming from that teaching of monotheism, giving a, either injecting in a god that gets elevated above the others, or taking the essence of that was already there and tweaking it up and elevating it above the others. Depending on how the Sethite priests handled the situation, right? Whether or not they kind of took what was there or injected something definitively new. Same way with the Melchizedek missionaries, doing the same thing. How they approached what they found for an evolutionary context that they stepped into.
That's the henoism?
Hen just is Greek for one. Yeah, okay. So henotheism.
How that worked in evolutionary reminds me of how in the book it said it would have been better for Christians not to have tried to take away the religions of the different races and mm-hmm. replace. They were sticking their finger in trying to change it, mm-hmm. but how that evolved.
Right, the Sethite priests or the Melchizedek missionaries that were the most successful are the ones that thought in the most evolutionary terms. Those that came in as You know, revolutionaries might have had short-term success, but, you know, it didn't last. Those who thought in very long-term evolutionary fashion gave those people something of enduring benefit. And that's what you should think about in everything you do. If you want to improve something in government or something in society, you know, can you humbly think in long-term evolutionary terms? Can you recognize the truth of what is already in existence as opposed to thinking falsely existentially? It's like, well, that's not perfect, so that's innately bad, 100%. Throw it all out. Replace it with what's in my head, which is innately divine. All right? Can you not think like that? You know, no, there's some truth there. Let me foster that into an improved factual expression based upon my enlightenment. You know, and the people will be able to take that little step, and they'll be able to hold on to what they acquired after, you know, with that one step themselves. You won't have to sit there and reinforce it every 5 seconds. They will uphold it and maintain it themselves. You know, if you engaged them in evolutionary terms. Yeah. Who taught us to think otherwise? Kalagastia, right? Who taught Kalagastia? Lucifer, right? Yeah. Oh, by the way, I did glance over here and I saw where it said about the failure of India to achieve the hegemony of Eurasia was largely a matter of topography. Population pressure from the north only crowded the majority of the people southward into the decreasing territory of the Deccan, surrounded on all sides by the sea. I knew it said it somewhere back there. See, there's that surrounded on all sides by the sea. And see, that's literally what's, you know, behind the Dravida root of Dravidian, right? Is that the literalness of that fact, that you're surrounded on all sides by the sea. Anyway, back to the Dravidian people here. Okay, let's see. Threat of monotheism, we got that. Okay, I think I fleshed that all out. But see, that's just very important to appreciate how the relationship between revelation and evolution there. That evolution produces polytheism. Revelation by, you know, epical mode tweaks that into henotheism, where one God gets elevated above the others. And then your internal auto-revelation finally clarifies it, right? Where you let go of all the others, right? And recognize there's just one God the Father. And then the fifth epical revelation comes along and complicates things by bringing in deity. So God gets more complicated. But, but when you're starting bottom up from the individuality viewpoint, step, you know, the first goal is to get rid of many first sources and centers and recognize there can only be one first source and center. Right? That's the only logical possibility. There can't be many. You know, and then to bring in the top-down viewpoint of deity. All right. What do we have here next?
As early as 16,000 BC, a company of 100 Sithite priests entered India and very nearly achieved the religious conquest of the western half of that polyglot people. But their religion did not persist. Within 5,000 years, their doctrines of the Paradise Trinity had degenerated into the triune symbol of the fire god.
Do you remember who the fire god is? Agni. Agni is the fire god, the three-headed fire god. All right, so, you know, where does that three-headed fire god, you know, symbolism come from? It goes all the way back to the Sethite priests. Not just, see, trying to foster monotheism, but, see, they're already bringing in more sophisticated stuff. They're thinking beyond that to trying to get people to a bottom-up recognition of the Paradise Trinity by having three persons, so adding two persons in addition to the one, which obviously is going to be pretty confusing. You know, it's like, what do you mean adding two more persons? I thought you wanted me to get rid of all of the other gods and just have this one god. Jack, yeah, well, that was just step one. Okay, step two is now to bring in two valid coordinate gods to that first god. And not only that, but then to think in bottom-up terms that there's a super summative consequence of the relationship between the three, which is the Paradise Trinity.
Did they think of it as super summative, though?
No, of course. You know, but see, I mean, all the teachers would have been initially trying to get them to have is just three gods. And the idea that they work really closely together, but see, they're trying to set it up so that eventually you can get to the Paradise Trinity bottom up. And you go, well, why at such an early stage bring in, you know, that much complication? Why not just be satisfied at such an early stage with just trying to foster monotheism? Well, because of what I talk about all the time, why we have the fifth epical revelation now. Right? I mean, technically, if you're going to have a people that are stepping forward into civilization and trying to move forward, they have to have the concept of the whole. Right? They have to have the concept that what you're trying to set up in your civilization is a system, that there's parts that work together in a coordinated fashion because they're parts of a whole. All right, so that's why they're trying to, so early to push this, so that you can get that fundamental recognition that this distinction is vital. For in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole, the Paradise Trinity, and through the individuality of the whole, the Mother. Right? That they're not going to be taking that step towards the Paradise Trinity with those who are just merely a society or just merely a culture. But if they're beginning to actually use the seventh adjutant and their encirclement in the Holy Spirit, their personality to a significant degree and have a civilization, they're immediately going to try to get them to understand that if you're going to make this progressing civilization work, you have to think in terms of a system, that it's not magic. That's going to hold your civilization together. It's thinking in these very holistic terms about how to coordinate all the diverse individuals together in a way that that minimizes the innate tensions that exist between you know, the more enlightened peoples and the less enlightened peoples and, you know, and what have you, right? You can't just say, well, let's just, you know, kill all or ignore all of the lessers and let's just, no, I mean, if it's going to be a civilization, it has to have all that complexity. And so you have to know how to establish an equitable system.
Is that the unity without uniformity?
All right, you're going to bring in unity, and you're going to establish a harmony, right? You have all the individuals of different flavors in the presence of a common unity that produces a harmony, right, doesn't leave anyone out. They all can be brought together in a system.
This is
what they are actually trying to foster. And like I was saying, it all begins with that religious spark, right? That those greater, say, governmental or social constructs, issues, theories, what have you, ideas, those all are sparked by a religious predicate that you think about God and your relationship to God in system terms. And to do that, you need the rudiments of the whole, the Paradise Trinity. The idea that there's a threefold phenomenon that produces an essential wholeness within which everything exists.
It's different with Catholicism, though. They have the Trinity, but not the Paradise Trinity.
Right. I mean, the Trinity of Christendom. I mean, it's not just Catholicism, but the Trinity of Christendom is again, it's the current. It's like the three-headed fire god. Right, it's a threefold notion. It's like, well, why did we dream up this threefold notion with the universal Father, Jesus, and this vague thing we call the Holy Spirit, or the Holy Ghost? Right? Why? Because long ago, in our case, you don't have to go all the way back to Adam and Eve. You just go back to Machiavelli and Melchizedek. Teaching about the Paradise Trinity, and he's teaching it bottom up, so he's teaching about three individuals, and trying to get you to think about those three individuals working in this incredible coordinate way, and that coordination, see, that abstraction, that coordination is the whole, is the Paradise Trinity. We had that fed into us a third time with Machiavelli Melchizedek, and Christendom, did its best to create some sort of a literal construct, based upon that encouragement from Machiavelli, right, to think in these threefold terms.
Practice in our church, the Trinity is recognized when we sing the doxology, Father, Son, Spirit. But it's never talked about. It's never really taught.
Right. Right. Monotheism is taught. Right. Yeah. Because again, it's too advanced. One needs to recognize why it is that you have merely the Trinity of Christendom instead of something that's more literally like the Universal Father, the Eternal Son, the Infinite Spirit, or the Conjoint Actor. Why don't you have something that's more directly like that? Because that's how limited we are. That's as abstract as we can get, and that's not adequate. All right, the fifth epical revelation is saying, no, there has to be a few people on the planet that can challenge themselves to a greater level of abstract thinking. You must challenge yourself, because you have to think more abstractly to get to the truth. Otherwise, you just have gross anthropomorphisms, right? Why did we, basically call the third person of the Trinity of Christendom the Holy Ghost? Because we're still trying to keep the ghost cult going, not an indirect way, but in a direct way, right? That there's this God, this monotheistic God, and then there's two different expressions of that monotheistic God. There's that God made flesh and that God made ghost. Just like there's two expressions of you. There's you in flesh, and then you die, and then you're a ghost, right? The old ghost notion, right? If you have those two things, well, then God must, you know, express himself in those two different modes, you know? That's all it is just a taking that Paradise Trinity concept and putting it in the old wineskin of the ghost cult. All right, and you know, and then you notice that subsequent to being called the Holy Ghost, you started calling it the Holy Spirit. Why? Because in the evolution of the ghost cult, first you just had ghosts, and then you had the idea of exalted ghosts, which you called spirits. I mean, it's just you're just repeating the whole evolutionary process again, you know, in the way you use the words and everything, just like they did countless millennia ago, right, when they were first dreaming up the ghost cult. All right. Let's see. What else? Oh, yeah, we got it there. Okay, so back to this paragraph. Okay, as early as 16,000 BC, you had the Sethite priests going in there. What's significant about that? It's before 15,000 BC. So, in other words, very early on, you know, kind of technically pre-Andite, you know, when it was still kind of quasi-Adamite, these migrations. So at a very early stage, you had Sethite priests going in there, what they're reminding you of there by that date. Not way, way, way back. It isn't like 25,000 BC, because we are clear over in India now. You know, we are moving quite a ways away from the homeland here, okay? But still, so these roots in India of revelatory tweaking of religion run very deep. That's why the religion in India is so complicated. It got sort of primed way back, and it has had lots of time to get very complex. Let's see. All right, and then, so within 5,000 years, their doctrines of the Paradise Trinity had degenerated. So you get to 11,000 BC. Remember, you know, we've talked about that whole range of 10,000 BC and stuff. Okay, so we're taking you forward to those sorts of times where it's all washed kind of into the evolutionary soup again. Okay.
But for more than 7,000 years, down to the end of the Andite migrations, the religious status of the inhabitants of India was far above that of the world at large. During these times, India bid fair to produce the leading cultural, religious, philosophic, and commercial civilization of the world. And but for the complete submergence of the Andites by the peoples of the South, this destiny would probably have been realized.
Obviously, they have to say probably. There's all kinds of things that you know, might have happened that won't for different reasons. Okay, but the first thing is just, okay, taking you all the way forward another 7,000 years. So, you know, there you're getting all the way to 4,000 BC. So, you know, well, wait a minute. I thought the last Andite migrations were in the 8,000 to 6,000 BC. Well, the sort of the big waves. But, you know, especially a nearby place that has this much draw to it, right? There are still trickles of Andites coming in even after 6,000 BC. And what they're basically doing is kind of taking you all the way up to when you had ceased to call what's coming in an Andite migration, and you need to flip to that Aryan word. Okay. So they're taking you all the way, you know, in just prior to times when you're going to talk about people coming in an uplifting fashion as Aryans rather than Andites. And see, again, notice how they're holding up the religious element because of its spark. The religious status far above the world at large. And like we were just talking about, that whole ghost cult and all that sort of stuff. I mean, most people are wallowing in very primitive stuff. I mean, they're just trying to move out of nature worship. They're bringing in vague notions of, that are reifying dreamland and whatnot, right? And these people have this very, after over many millennia, people coming in trying to encourage monotheism. They have a very significant quality to their religious life there relative to everyone else. Does everyone know what the expression bid fair means? I have a fair chance of such and so. And it's likely. Right? It means that it seemed likely that India was going to produce. Bid fair means it seemed likely. The bid, it's sort of putting it forward where you see it, right? It seems likely. Like they were saying before, that this was going to be, I even read that, right, when I went back for the Surrounded on All Sides by the Sea, right, the failure of India to achieve the hegemony of Eurasia, right, to be that leader, right, they're mentioning that again. They had everything, that they needed, cultural, religious, philosophic, commercial. They were going to be the full package, matter, mind, and spirit, as it were, for the whole world, except for that genetic issue, right, that's always messed it up. If it isn't slaves that are brought in to serve the elites, and then eventually the elites mate with the slaves and bring everything down. If it isn't slaves that have been imported, it's just the Aboriginal people that are there that are a boat anchor. Yep.
When I read this, I keep thinking it's the live carriers writing it. But when I check, it's an archangel.
Yeah.
They must have gotten information from life carriers and from midwares, and perhaps, but somehow it's an archangel that compiled it.
Well, since you brought that up, that the author is an archangel, that reminder again that why bring in such a high individual to speak about such apparently lowly factual details, historical details, because he needs to see to it that there's a very top-down nature to the story that's there for you to strike step with and get to the truth of it, that it isn't just dry scholarly facts recited, regurgitated by some cistern of knowledge. That's that high objective vantage point that archangel brings into play. And as we mentioned before, well, obviously must not be just, some archangel from way out, yonder in Lebanon somewhere. It must be an archangel that's been here, probably still is here. Right? Maybe he's one that's stationed here, has been for a long time. Right? So he was observing all this. He's interacting with all the lesser players, of life carriers and whatnot, and midwayers. Although the midwayers, you know, that's a tricky thing. We've talked about that. He's not directly interacting with them, but, you know, he's aware of them, you know, and what they're up to. So he, you know, he can assimilate all of the data from below, as it were, and give you that top-down picture. Yeah. It's very important to always note who's writing it, because remember it's the person is selected to author a particular paper because they know of that which they speak. And so, you know, if you go, well, they're just speaking about lowly things. Why such a high author? Oh, they must not really be speaking of lowly things. I'm supposed to be getting something a lot higher out of this. Right? That's why I keep encouraging we've gone over an hour and we've only gone this far. We keep going off in these tangents, trying to stress the bigger picture of what we're reading. So you don't just go blah, 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 all this stuff 16,000 years ago. Who cares? And, because the facts of it are basically irrelevant, but there's a truth flowing through it. Okay. So let's see, what else do we have here? Okay, so more on this. So, yeah, the 7,000 years. Let's see, make sure I got everything here. We keep going off on these tangents, and I forget what we've read. Let's see, all that. We went through all of it. Yeah, that, and using the word destiny, this destiny would probably have been realized. So, again, see, they're reminding you of how much personal nature is in play. So that there's a forward orientation. You don't just have origin and history. You have destiny in play. Okay. All right.
The Dravidian centers of culture were located in the river valleys, principally of the Indus and Ganges, and in the Deccan along the three great rivers flowing through the eastern gates to the sea. The settlements along the seacoast of the Western Gates owed their prominence to maritime relationships with Samaria.
The Gots. That's why the H is there.
Oh, okay.
Right? If you didn't have an H, it would be a gate. Right? The Eastern Gots and the Western Gots. In other words, the Eastern Mountains and the Western Mountains. So, you know, remember we talked about the Deccan before. I even read that passage where in one of the sentences where they use the Deccan. I remember the Deccan is that lower triangular part of the subcontinent of India. And what does Deccan literally mean? It means the south. So the Deccan Plateau is the southern plateau of the Indian subcontinent. And that southern region has a mountain range on the west and a mountain range on the east side. You know, pretty much all the way up and down both sides. You've got, you know, over there in the west, of course, you've got the Indus Valley, you know, the Indus River, that great river, you know, in what's now Pakistan. And of course, going across the northern part, the plain there of the Ganges, the Gangetic Plain, north of the Deccan Plateau, you have the Ganges. And then as you head south from the Ganges, if you look on a map of India, you'll see that there's as you continue south, there's three big rivers that have cut through the eastern mountain range, you know, and dump out into a delta in the Bay of Bengal. Okay, so those are those, and you'll see that there's, you're staying still relatively north. You're not going all the way down to the very point, Because, of course, that's where you've driven the least of the peoples. And you're not, you know, there's not going to be civilization all the way down. You know, it's kind of a big river flowing into the Bay of Bengal way down there, too. But see, we're not going that far down. You know, so just taking those first three big rivers down along the east. Did you have something?
Well, whenever you have a river flowing through the mountains,
mm-hmm.
water flows downhill.
Yeah.
How's water going to cut a channel through the mountain?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's because the river was there before the mountain came up. And as the mountain came up, the channel of the river cut through the mountain.
Yeah, again, remember how active all these areas that we're reading about are. I mean, it's all a very active tectonic area. Lots of mountain building going on. Yep, so there's lots of, like Gene is saying, very old river runs that, get modified or subsequently modify the the topography, you know, when it gets elevated and whatnot. Yeah. You know, you have all kinds of wild things, you know, like, you know, because of the Himalayas, you know, rivers that take these very circuitous routes flowing around, you know, obviously way back before there were Himalayas, it was a short little river that just went straight south, say. Now it goes, you know, way to the east and then back around to the west, you know, is it, because you can imagine it, water was building up and finally it found a path to flow around the long way to get to where it wanted to go, and carved a long river valley, you know. Let's see here. Okay, so you've got mostly these settlements along those big rivers, with the one exception, and you've got the Western Ghats, you know, pretty close to the coast along the western side of India there. So you have this little area for you know, on the western side of the mountains there before you hit the Arabian Sea. You're going, what would be the draw to build anything in that little strip there along the coast? Well, we've already talked about that. You've got a significant commerce with across the Arabian Sea to Samaria. So every one of you knows one of those really big cities that's right there along the western coast.
Yeah.
What is it?
New Delhi.
Yeah, well, Bombay. Mumbai. Right? Mumbai, you know, what's now called Mumbai, which was called Bombay for a long time, right? That has a natural harbor there. Yeah, it's this great big city. It obviously goes way back. Right. It was, you know, a major port way, way, way back. You know, the commerce with Samaria coming into what's now Mumbai. So, you know, you would naturally settle into the river valleys, except when you've got that important commerce thing, and so you're going to have a big city built up there by that harbor. Okay, is there something else somewhere? Okay. Okay, just wanted to kind of get you to think about, see, we're not going to go into all of the details, but every time they make some little factual statement like that, I mean, if you're just thinking in factual terms, you're going, well, why would the revelers waste a whole paragraph on something that every, you know, grade schooler in India knows, the geography of their country or whatever? I mean, what is the point? Again, it's because they're trying to get you to reflect on it and think about why things ended up the way they did. That's what I was just giving you a little example of. I mean, an awful lot of it, I mean, I don't know enough about India or India's history to unpack it. You'd need a better expert, right? But I know that every time they're saying something that seems to be just way too two-dimensional, that's not the revelator's fault. That's my fault for not having the proper depth of recognition to appreciate what they're giving hints about how things came to be the way they are in India. Why certain people are where they are, and, you know, this sort of stuff.
It wouldn't fit in your lamp if they were going to fill all that out.
And again, the revelators don't fill all that stuff out because we can do that, and they're not allowed to give us stuff that we already know or that we can figure out ourselves. Okay, so that's what's going on there with that seemingly very straightforward little paragraph. Okay, keep going.
The Dravidians were among the earliest peoples to build cities and to engage in an extensive export and import business, both by land and sea. By 7000 BC, camel trains were making regular trips to distant Mesopotamia. Dravidian shipping was pushing coastwise across the Arabian Sea to the Sumerian cities of the Persian Gulf and was venturing on the waters of the Bay of Bengal as far as the East Indies. An alphabet, together with the art of writing, was imported from Samaria by these seafarers and merchants.
So even though you had cuneiform there in Samaria, right, you had the concept of an alphabet that they picked up on. Right? They constructed their own symbology and stuff, but it's all playing off of, oh, you can break down words into sound chunks, and those sound chunks into sequences of letters or a single letter, and you know, the concept of an alphabet, they're being taught that, and they say, oh, that's a cool thing. It makes it much simpler to think about, instead of having, you know, a whole bunch of pictures or whatever. And you can actually write things down. You know, not just think about what you're saying, but you can write it down. And so they're being taught all that. They take those concepts into their particular mode of mind and come up with their own particular flavor of characters and whatnot. Okay, but they're learning that from the Sumerians. And you know, obviously, if they're able to chug westward, you know, in the Arabian Sea over to the Persian Gulf, right? They can, you know, they don't have to go, you know, across the depths of the Bay of Bengal. They can just basically follow the coast, you know, and they're going to wrap down, you know, all the way to the East Indies and, you know, be interacting with that whole area.
It may have been really early, but some of them may have been, what's his name, Gonad's ancestors.
Yeah.
Because when you get to that point, Jesus went with the Indian traders, you know, say to yourself, well, you don't think of the Indians as being that wealthy and that, you know, up and coming, but at that time, I guess they really were.
Yeah.
Maybe it was 2,000 years ago, so maybe that tradition.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they, you know, as they're pointing out, they were a people with a very definitive impulse to become a significant seafaring trading civilization. You know, if you're just sitting there in Mesopotamia, you know, you're kind of just self-contained, and obviously if you're up in Turkestan, you're just doing things by land, and you know, we talked about the Silk Road up there and stuff. Okay, but seafaring, you know, as traders, if you're kind of stuck down there, poked out into the sea, right, it just naturally leads to that. Yeah, so, yeah, see, like I said, that's, you know, as you go from the previous paragraph to this one, extensive export-import business, yeah, like the fact of why do you have such a great big city stuck on the other, you know, on the west side of the mountain range there? Why do you have Bombay? Why do you have Mumbai? Yeah. Okay, a non-seafaring people wouldn't have built such a, you know, an enduring habitation, you know, location like that. All right. And, you know, see, the thing that, you know, that is really kind of unappreciated by historians is how long ago you had such a significant phenomenon. see, in India. You know, I mean, an expression like Dravidian shipping, okay? you know, thinking Dravidians, I mean, they, you know, aren't those like the untouchables and stuff? And okay, I mean, they don't have any civilization at all. Like, no, if you go way back, and they have the better of those peoples. You know, so by 7,000 BC, you've got the significant seafaring commerce going on. Right? I mean, Stone Age, see, seafaring commerce, okay? And, you know, so you might just think, it's like, well, you don't really have seafaring stuff, at least the Bronze Age, you know, not the Iron Age. No, no, it can be clear back there in the Stone Age, very significant seafaring phenomenon. All right, you know, and you're just not going to get that if you read, you know, the history of you know, ancient India. It all kinds of, it gets kind of mysterious prior to the Bronze Age. You might, you know, you might see how they recognized there were peoples with basic cities, you know, or, you know, large encampment sort of phenomenon going on way back to 7,000 BC, but they don't appreciate this kind of Andite-y motivated civilization. All evidence of that has gotten forgotten and lost. All right. Okay, I guess we got everything there. But just, oh, I was just going to stress, you know, not just, you know, the mainland of Southeast Asia, but the fact that they mentioned they're pushing all the way to the islands, see, the East Indies, all the way to the islands of Southeast Asia. So, you know, it's very extensive.
Yep. I understand the Vedas are 5,000 years old.
Right, we see, that's the whole point. We haven't gotten to the Aryans yet. You know, the fact that there's all this significant stuff going on that's what I'm saying is not appreciated. You know, in India, you actually have, you know, records that go back almost to this, but even there, you don't appreciate from what we have that there were Andites. That's what I'm trying to stress. These Dravidians, in their full flower, way back when, were an Andite civilization. And there's just no recognition that there was such a thing, right? They, you know, we think that the earliest sort of significant civilization was in the Indus Valley. You know, and we're just about to read about that. But you know, see, this is way, way back, thousands and thousands of years before that.
I don't know what Aryans are. Is that a long answer?
We're almost there. We're getting there. We're just about to get there. Yep. Okay. All right, keep going.
These commercial relationships greatly contributed to the further diversification of a cosmopolitan culture, resulting in the early appearance of many of the refinements and even luxuries of urban life. When the later appearing Aryans entered India, they did not recognize in the Dravidians their Andite cousins submerged in the Sangic races, but they did find a well-advanced civilization. Despite biologic limitations, the Dravidians founded a superior civilization. It was well diffused throughout all India and has survived on down to modern times in the Deccan.
Right, so, like they're pointing out, you know, the way Dravidian is used today, it's thought of as this more aboriginal phenomenon down in the Deccan, down in the south. But there was a time when, you know, it was throughout all of the Indian subcontinent, and it was the flower of human civilization, you know, in its day.
And today, you know, most of the big biotech companies are down in that area. What the story I heard was is that the government started to educate the people in the South, and not the people in the North, on a political aspect of things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, since that time, the people in the South have really, you know, grown culturally greater than the people in the North because of the education, and probably because of this latent.
Yeah. You'll see that they're going to mention that some more. They do try to stress that there is a lot of latent potential still there. It looks hopeless in a lot of areas, but it's just an unfortunate, benighted cultural veneer, you know, that's slathered all over everything and kind of has it locked in place. If you could just tap it with a light hammer and shatter that unfortunate, you know, veneer, there's a people underneath that can be animated and made a very dynamic phenomenon because they have such a diversity of racial stock underlying them. And even if they can't initiate some things themselves because they have such a, you know, limited andite nature now, they can follow suit very well. Okay? And they might even be able to follow suit in ways that others can't, if you will, right? You know, you can get them going, and you put what's moving now is different than what you got moving over here in a different genetic stock, and it just naturally expresses in ways that it doesn't in other places. But it won't get itself moving. You have some, you know, a spark has to come, a more andite spark has to come in and get it going. But there's actually some very encouraging things, and then you're just bringing that out. They're discovering that you can take these peoples that, you know, for millennia everyone has rejected just out of hand, you know, an a priori dismissal that they could, you know, be anything significant. You can recognize otherwise and actually get some things going with some of those peoples. Yeah.
Okay, Dick, I like curry.
They aren't as limited as some on the planet because they have a lot of primary sanghic blended in, right? And they have a fair amount of andite that was blended in too. It's very interesting how they will give us that a very definitive encouragement to come on, don't underestimate them, you know, give them a chance.
Right, you have something? An interesting paragraph here in paper 94.
Uh-huh.
You know, it goes, today in India, the great need is for the portrayal of the Jesusonian gospel, the fatherhood of God and the sonship and consequent brotherhood of all men, which is personally realized in loving ministry and social service. In India, the philosophical framework is existing.
Yep.
The cult structure is present. All that is needed is the vitalizing spark of the dynamic love portrayed in the original gospel of the Son of Man, divested of Occidental dogmas and doctrines.
Repeating, you know, what I'm telling you is flowing through what we have here, right? That religion is the spark. You know, and unlike a lot of peoples, they have a philosophic framework that's dormant. It hasn't been totally thrown out, but it's dormant because there's no vital religious spark at the nucleus of it.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool. Yep. All right. Let's get to the Aryans here, and I'll explain it a little bit more here.
Number four, the Aryan invasion of India. The second Andite penetration of India was the Aryan invasion during a period of almost 500 years in the middle of the third millennium before Christ. This migration marked the terminal exodus of the Andites from their homelands in Turkestan.
Okay, so see how we've gotten to this point in the timeline before. You see what they're doing. They're in India. They're they're giving you everything up to kind of that 2000 BC. All right, so you're in the third millennium, you know, so from 3000 BC to 2000 BC. They're kind of bringing everything in the different areas up to that point. And unlike some areas, you have this very significant, basically Andite, but it's, you might want to say it's Andite-like, because it's at such a late date here. I mean, obviously these, this quote-unquote second Andite penetration of India, that's kind of Andite sort of in truth and less in sort of direct fact now, because obviously any peoples all the way down to the third millennium BC, there would have been a fair amount of blending with those peoples to the north that are coming south into India. So they aren't as they aren't as pure, if you will, as elevated a people genetically. But nonetheless, in relative terms, it's effectively an Andite, a second Andite penetration at this very late date, way subsequent to 6000 BC now. Okay. So see, that's another thing. You get, in very recent times, you have these injections into India of kind of some of the better residual stuff on the planet. Okay. And so there's two reasons for them using Aryan here. One, I just said, it's handy to have a word that kind of indicates that there's a slight difference from what we've been calling Andite before in more ancient times. These aren't as high a genetic people. But also, that's a historical word, right? In Indian written history, you have these peoples coming into India, and that's recorded, and they're called the Aryans, the noble ones. Okay, obviously, that was a term coined by them to describe themselves. Right, we're coming into this benighted Sangic domain. We're the noble ones here. We're going to set up a caste system. Etc. Okay, but that's it's noble is the root there.
They came as conquerors.
They, to a degree, yeah. I mean, they recognized right up front how outnumbered they were. So they weren't delusional. They didn't really think they were going to just conquer everything. But they certainly thought they could set themselves up as the rulers in this land. As the noble ones, right? The nobility amongst the others. And notice it's over over 500 years. So this whole bit about a second Andite penetration. That first one was over thousands and thousands of years, and we were seeing how it had some very big initial things, and then it had an ongoing trickling phenomenon, and then there's kind of a short lull, and then there's sort of a final little spurt, spread over several centuries. And in the middle of the third millennium BC. So none of this is like Alexander the Great going to India to conquer it, right? In this very definitive spear-like effort, spear point-like effort. See, that's why I'm saying don't think of it so much as a you know, invaders trying to conquer, and you know, they all ride in, you know, zillions of them on horses, you know, trying to conquer a place. So they're trickling in over several centuries and just kind of want to set themselves up as the nobility here.
And the Sanguine race is, I remember you seeing in the past that in people from India, you could see.
Right. I mean, there's a number of people in India that have a significant amount of green men. Yeah. But again, there's orange men, indigo men, red men, blue men, yellow men. They're all there. All the Sanghiks are there.
Okay.
It's just the reason that you can see some green there and some dark-skinned peoples there, because there was such a significant amount of green that went there relative to the amount of green that went other places.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so that's the deal. That's the deal with the Aryans. They're still coming down from the north, from Turkestan. But that's it. Now you've drained Turkestan. But we already saw that before. That was the whole thing, you know, when we were talking about Mesopotamia proper. Right? By the time you get to 2000 BC, you've drained the whole Turkestan, you know, as a source. And anything coming, you know, there subsequently, you know, are relatively barbarians. You know, like the Babylonians coming in. Yep.
You know, when I first read about the Aryan invasion of India, you know, it brought back thoughts of, you know, the Hitler thing being an Aryan race, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Could you speak to that for a minute?
Yep.
Where did that come from?
Right, so...
It's so far away from...
Right, so, I mean, the Nazis... I mean, it's not way off track. I mean, the Nazis, took a hold of that, these oldest historical records, speaking of a great people of the past that has gotten relatively submerged amongst lesser peoples, and they wanted to collect those greater peoples out of the morass that they're in, bring them to a homeland, and reestablish. See, the essence of what they were doing, even though they didn't know they were doing, they were trying to reestablish a dynamic Andite-like civilization. Right? They don't have the word Andite. The oldest word tying to this is coming from India, and it's Aryan, and they adopt the swastika, right, from there too, right, the symbology from there, right. They're trying to tap into that, they're going through Tibet looking for blue-eyed peoples and trying to bring them to the new homeland. And it's all you blue-eyed peoples, you should we should refound an Andite civilization. Because before the Nazis gave this taint to the word Aryan, you know, where now it's thought of as a negative word, it was sort of one of the most positive words in existence. It was a word that indicated that despite lots of problems on the planet, there's an innate nobility to mankind. Okay? See, and they're being taught about that. Why? Because it goes back to Adam and Eve. Those two nobles that came down from Gerizim, right? The Nazis are picking up on the truth of history and then twisting it. And that's why what they did was so powerful, because it was predicated on truths rather than mere facts. And humans unconsciously pick up on that energy. And it's more compelling when it seems to be of eternity instead of merely of time. And you they created a quasi-religious sort of sparking phenomenon to, you know, to their movement. And, you know, they recognized what how this works. Yeah.
Except they got rid of genetically superior people.
Right. We all know that there's ignorance in all this, but to, I mean, but just to appreciate that. You know, it wasn't just the Nazis, of course. The Nazis are just picking up on what was going on in the beginning of the 20th century as scientists were really beginning to put genetic things together and recognizing, you know, wait a minute, there's actually record of the fact that there's greater and lesser genetics and you know, and the whole concept of eugenics, right? The caste system is eugenics, right? And you know that there, you know, humans have known this for a long time. Mankind sort of rediscovered that at the beginning of the 20th century. I mean, beginning to openly talk about eugenics and seeing that we had in recorded history talking about the Aryans, right, as sort of the oldest recorded example of this fact of a hierarchy of genetics, and a need to manage that in some wise way. Right, you know, the Nazis proper, see, took the truths that the scientists of the time had come to recognize and go, oh, I could use that to my own advantage. I could twist that. Okay? And of course, then it feeds back because they twisted it. Everyone concluded that it's innately twisted. Right?
It must have sent a shudder.
Yeah.
Even while the Revelation is forming, mm-hmm. you know, they're having to watch some really choice things get twisted and trashed and taking on more baggage. That,
like I said, but they, you know, they knew how this would play out. I mean, they knew how politically incorrect these paragraphs were going to be in the not too distant future. But it doesn't change the facts. All right, the facts that were being recognized back at the beginning of the 20th century are valid. We just have to overcome our fear of those facts. See, and again, you think you can twist the things that Jesus said, right? Or the things that Machiavelli said, or Adam and Eve said, or the Prince's Staff said. There's never been anything given to us that can be twisted to such horrendous ends as what's sitting in my lap, right? Right, so, you know, again, the more positive potential is in play, the more negative potential is in play.
Which side of the sword is up in there? Well, it's increased the challenge because it's you can recognize error, but that doesn't tell you what truth is. Truth is not the opposite of error.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Like I said, because of the errors, because of the erroneous way that the Nazis utilized the concept of genetics, the conclusion was that there is no truth to eugenics. It's like, no, just because falsehood exists, it doesn't mean that truth doesn't exist, right? But we have a hard time. We've had, for 2,600 years, we've had a hard time not falling into that trap of thinking that falsehood negates the existence of truth in general. Most people poo-poo the notion of a revelation of truth because only delusional people think there's such a thing as truth. We figured out a long time ago, there is no such thing. Objective, there is no such thing.
Chris, there's one little thing. Yeah. I noticed that if I'm into eugenics and open to it, it's almost like anyone can be, because I was dead set against it. So maybe more people are open to it.
I mean, inescapably, mankind will face it again. We're moving forward in our genetic knowledge,
Maybe Albert should make
we're inescapably encircled in the Holy Spirit. We inescapably have the word well in our vocabulary. You have genetics because of scientific progress. You have the word well. The two come together. Eugenics, right? They inescapably will come together. EU means well. It's impossible for mankind to stare at genetic facts and not think, there's greater and lesser, in this, right? This kind of genetics works better than that kind of genetics. It's inescapable that you'll notice the differentials, right? So we can try to close our eyes and hum and pretend that, eugenics doesn't exist, but, there's no way for us to avoid it. The recognition of its existence dawning in our minds. The only way to not have it, the thought dawn in your mind is to stop thinking about genetic issues.
If nothing else, you can recognize that one's own genetics are not... doesn't matter about other people's genetics.
I mean, just think about anything. If I stare at my garden, I could go, I could make this garden better if I did it like this. You can't help but have the thought of making something better. The only way to not have it is to never look at your garden, to never have the thought of a better garden. It's impossible for you to not think in better terms or to imagine something better. So... did you have something?
Well, there's a great article today on NPR about genetic editing versus genetic modified organisms, GMO versus GE. And, as opposed to doing it one way, which is the modification of taking things from the outside, they're actually editing the genes that are in the plants now themselves. And it doesn't have to go through USDA or FDA or whatever. And they're getting, So my point is that as plants begin to be done that way, the next thing I can see it happening, it'll be animals the next thing that's happening, and then over time, it'll start to eventually get into disease, and then it'll be in the human thing. And I would be surprised if in the next, 100 years for sure, we're beyond the Hitler fear and getting into more things, if nothing else from the health point of view, and then gradually into other areas, but... seems to be happening, and it definitely supports mine. And when they say in the book that the, I think it was a Melchizedek or something, have a solution or something like that to be able to do it. What I thought it was is I think that they somehow made Watson and Crick recognize that the DNA was a spiral, what's it called, spiral staircase, and because they had a hard time figuring it out, and then they sort of, and something clicked, and and then was brought in, and that could have very easily happened from them, and then all of a sudden, we figured that out. Now it's the first step for moving forward.
We will always think in progressive terms about anything that we consider. It's inescapable, right? And as we've talked about many times, when we're deeply settled in light and life, every single living thing on this planet will be completely genetically re-engineered by that time. Nothing is made in its final state in an evolutionary domain. That's the way things are made in Havona, in the central universe, not out here. Right? They're made as far away from their final state as possible.
So they can grow.
Everything has to, and initially the personality management of that change is, just in the, the personality of the creative mother spirit, say, of a local universe. Right? But eventually it's the beings on the planet that are doing the personality management. Okay, back to the story here. We're going to get into this here. Okay, so keep going.
The early Aryan centers were scattered over the north half of India, notably in the northwest. These invaders never completed the conquest of the country and subsequently met their undoing in this neglect, since their lesser numbers made them vulnerable to absorption by the Dravidians of the south, who subsequently overran the entire peninsula except the Himalayan provinces.
Hey, remember, you know, the most northern parts of India, you know, are, you know, in the Himalayas. Notably in the northwest. What is that? All right, the Indus Valley. All right, we're talking, now we've got the Indus Valley civilization.
Is that north of Pakistan? Or is...
No, the Indus is going right through Pakistan.
Okay, yeah. Right through Pakistan.
Yeah. Right, northwest India is now Pakistan. That's the Indus Valley. They don't say it here, but this, what we're talking about, see, with the Aryans, is establishing the full flower of the Indus Valley civilization. And notice, see, this is in, somewhere in the ballpark of 2500 BC. Okay. And that's exactly when the full flower was. But we recognize there was an Indus Valley civilization of a lesser nature before that. Yeah, that's the Dravidian, the pre-Aryan version. Like they told us, they were in the Indus Valley and the Ganges and the other major rivers. Right? So there's a pre-Aryan civilization there as well. What's not recognized is how significant that was way, 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 way back, pre-Aryan.
Right?
What was that?
It was Morandite, right?
That you can go way back and have some very significant Andite influences there that would give a very significant civilization. But all that's, you know, lost now, washed away or buried. But, you know, we still have the structures that the Aryan built there. But anyway, so that's what, you know, and now we're in Bronze Age now, in the Indus Valley there with the Aryan Indus Valley civilization. Okay, keep going.
The Aryans made very little racial impression on India, except in the northern provinces. In the Deccan, their influence was cultural and religious, more than racial. The greater persistence of the so-called Aryan blood in northern India is not only due to their presence in these regions in greater numbers, but also because they were reinforced by later conquerors, traders, and missionaries. Right on down to the first century before Christ, there was a continuous infiltration of Aryan blood into the Punjab, the last influx being attendant upon the campaigns of the Hellenistic peoples.
All right, so just like we saw this, you know, there's this ongoing trickle of beyond 6,000 BC. All right, you effectively have Andite coming in because of Alexander the Great. All right? And over those three centuries, those three Hellenistic centuries, right up to birth of Christ. Once the Andites went there and founded a civilization, that's the draw. It can be like Alexander. It's like, well, that civilization needs to be under my umbrella. Or maybe it's just, oh, I want to go where the action is, you know, and join them.
You may have products there.
But you build it and they come, okay? And they come and come for millennia. Okay. All right, so, see, again, they're reminding you that you know, it's been a draw for a very long time of Andite blood. Even if that Andite blood initially went the opposite direction, it ended up coming back there, right? It went west, you know, and formed Greece, but ended up back there when Alexander the Great, you know, conquered India, the western part of India. Okay, so again, it there's all this latent potential in India because all that anti-blood has trickled in. All right.
On the Gangetic Plain, Aryan and Dravidian eventually mingled to produce a high culture, and this center was later reinforced by contributions from the Northeast coming from China.
Okay, so you've got that that plain to the north, like I said, you see, like I said, the better Dravidians, you know, blended in with the Aryans, you know, and then all the reinforcements they're talking about, you know, you definitely end up in the present day with the definitive north-south differential in India. Like I've said many times, it's because of Andite. The Andite influence is always preferentially feeding into the northern regions of areas and producing these north-south differentials, whether it's China or India or, you know, whatever it is. Okay?
In India, many types of social organizations flourished from time to time, from the semi-democratic systems of the Aryans to despotic and monarchical forms of government. But the most characteristic feature of society was the persistence of the great social castes that were instituted by the Aryans in an effort to perpetuate racial identity. This elaborate caste system has been preserved on down to the present time.
See, and the Nazis would defend themselves and say, no, we didn't dream this up. This is a time-honored tradition. The noble people have been doing this forever. Like I said, so you can take something like that and twist it. All right, so, you know, and notice that you had semi-democratic systems, because again, so you... when you've got that Andite blood, you can think in more sophisticated fashion about government. You can actually start to push beyond monarchical. But obviously, it's going to have a tendency to fall back. And of course, that's what we're wondering now. It's like, are we going to a republic if you can keep it? All right? And if not, you'll fall back into monarchical situation. You know, in order to have order again. Okay.
Of the four great castes, all but the first were established in the futile effort to prevent racial amalgamation of the Aryan conquerors with their inferior subjects. But the premier caste, the teacher priests, stems from the Sethites. The Brahmins of the 20th century after Christ are the lineal cultural descendants of the priests of the Second Garden, albeit their teachings differ greatly from those of their illustrious predecessors.
Okay, you know, so those the four castes, right, the whole point is to you know, divide up society, you know, so that it functions kind of within itself and is bounded away from the tribal and lesser peoples.
The untouchables.
Yeah, including the untouchables, yes. you know, I mean, the point of the four castes is to separate them from an effective fifth caste. See? Okay, yeah, and I think it's, you know, pretty obvious when they, you know, that first one they're talking about, that's the Brahmins. Okay.
They're the linear culture descendants of the
priests? Yeah, they're just pointing out, I mean, right, that, you know, because we had the significant Sethite stuff going all the way back to 16,000 BC, right, it's a very strong tradition that carries all the way into the founding of the caste system by the Aryans.
Interesting.
Yeah. Even though it's, you know, like they're saying, totally muddled up, you know, in its ideas, religious ideas, but nonetheless, right, it has its energy and it has its exaltation predicated on all the way back on the Sethites.
A few years ago, our church was interested in these other religions and their traditions and so forth. We had a visitor come who was a Brahmin. And my impression of him was he was steeped in tradition, but it's like there was no life in what he was saying.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, when you read about the Brahmins, that's, you know, eventually it just became totally dead. It's not living anymore. It just becomes totally conventionalized and formalized, and it doesn't have living truth flowing through it anymore. But they don't think any less of themselves because of it. Right. They still think of themselves as those who are immediately surrounding the core thread of truth, all right? And then the other castes, you know, are in concentric circles, you know, outside of that central core of the Brahmins.
Did he dress in robes? Did he have robes or special clothing?
I don't even remember that.
There's always affectation to those who see themselves as the closest to the truth. Yes. Okay, keep going.
When the Aryans entered India, they brought with them their concepts of deity as they had been preserved in the lingering traditions of the religion of the second garden. But the Brahmin priests were never able to withstand the pagan momentum built up by the sudden contact with the inferior religions of the Deccan after the racial obliteration of the Aryans. Thus, the vast majority of the population fell into the bondage of the enslaving superstitions of inferior religions, and so it was that India failed to produce the high civilization which had been foreshadowed in earlier times.
So there again, the latter part, you see that the passage that John, you know, read from, you know, farther up in the book. Again, you're missing that religious spark, that religious nucleus. Notice the one little detail. They brought with them their concepts of deity. See? Like I said, I mean, because it's, there's actually an effort to get to that beginning sort of existential foundation of a deity perspective, the Paradise Trinity, to actually transcend God and get to deity. You know, they were trying to do that, like I was saying, you know, that initial bottom up. And if you go bottom up and get to the, you know, to that pure existential deity, the Paradise Trinity, that's your doorway to the rest of deity. From a top-down point of view. Anyway, you know, just notice that they're that's why they said it that way. Don't think of that as a synonym for God, because in the Urantia book, it's not. Okay.
The spiritual awakening of the 6th century before Christ did not persist in India, having died out even before the Mohammedan invasion. But someday, a greater Gautama may arise to lead all India in the search for the living God. And then the world will observe the fruition of the cultural potentialities of a versatile people, so long comatose under the benumbing influence of an unprogressing spiritual vision.
See, there it is.
Yeah,
really. One day, they say, but someday, a greater Gautama, right, may arise. I mean, they don't know for certain, but they can see everything is there. If you just coincidentally, through the evolutionary process that no one can predict, right, get that sparking individual, right, it could ignite a great flame. It's lying dormant. It's long comatose.
They refer to that as the shifting of the Dharma.
Yeah, and of course they can't resist some alliteration, a greater Gautama. And you know, see, they got this, you know, there's a lot of the 6th century BC awakening stuff that happened there in India, but yeah, again, there's so much lesser. Yeah, stuff just washes down into the, you know, into the lowlands, intellectual lowlands, in very short order. You know, you start out with Gautama, and then the revelators say it doesn't take long, and there's only one word that can describe the ideas that you have subsequently, and that's grotesque. Okay, so yeah. See, when it washes down, it gets very ugly, as the revelators directly say. But anyway, it's great potential nonetheless. Okay.
Culture does rest on a biologic foundation, but caste alone could not perpetuate the Aryan culture. For religion, true religion, is the indispensable source of the higher energy which drives men to establish a superior civilization based on human brotherhood.
The 4 indispensables of advancing civilization? What's the first one? True religion. Right, that's what begins it, like they're saying. Right, you can't get to advancing civilization except through that first indispensable, true religion. Just repeating that again.
Based on what you're just going to say, if you look around, a lot of the world is lacking that true religion. Am I missing that? It seems that.
Yes, I mean, everyone is lacking that true religion. It's such an important element. That's why it can appear on first blush that this is a religious text that's in my lap. No, it's much more than that. But no philosophic text is a genuine philosophic text if it doesn't have a genuine religious nucleus. You can't have genuine philosophy except predicated on genuine science and genuine religion. Right? So, and they're just stressing it there. And you know, there it is. You know, true religion is the indispensable. Right. Those 4 indispensables of advancing civilization. All right. Well, we'll shift gears next time. We get a little bit of a... we drop back and get some ancient predicate with red men and yellow men so that we set the stage properly for moving over to China. Yeah, and we've talked about the red man, yellow man stuff some a number of times before, but they, you know, they have some additional things that they want to bring in here. So we kind of have to back way up and go through some of those details again. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.